Okay, hello everybody, and excuse for the delay. And fortunately, I decided to not have an overlong talk because what I'm going to talk about is related to the topic of the conference, but a little bit on the sidelines. So I decided not to fill it with all kind of details, but to concentrate on the core concepts. So. We talk about mostly locomotion and self-organized robots. So robots have not yet been considered so much here. And nowadays we are living in a world of robots, and actually in the future probably more than nowadays. some of these are very highly sophisticated and actuated. And the problem, as you see, is that you will have many joints, many actuators, and so you will have to fine-tune the commands, and it's a highly complex control problems. But and one of the ideas we are pursuing is not really for industrial application, but more for theoretical purposes, is to reduce this control problem dramatically. Now, robots can come in all kinds of forms. For example, this is a tube robot, which is compressing along the way, and that is for purposes where you go into tubes and you investigate whether there's some stuff going on where you normally don't go. And actually, this is philosophically quite interesting, an exoskeleton, which helps a handicapped person, whether you consider an exoskeleton as a robot or not, because it's also living environment. It's creating, it's acting on sensory input. So the sensory input is stress, and it generates a motor output. Of course, it's a very different environment where an exoskeleton lives in or reacts in, but in certain sense, you could consider it also a robot. Now, we are not considering these kind of robots. We are doing much, much simpler stuff. And we are also not doing what normal robot control is. It's highly elaborated. You want to do something, you do some trajectory planning, you do control algorithm, the actuators, the robot, the environment. You have all kind of feedback loops in all kind of levels in order to get this kind of working. So this is normally control, and I just put up the slides because we will do self-organization, not control, as a contrast. So to make that clear, in a very simplified version, we have sensors, which can all kind of sensory modality can come in. We have some controller, it may be a neural network, like the brain of a fly or whatever. This might be designed, if it's industrialized, it might be evolutionary optimized, like C. elegans. But I think C. elegans has a neural network which is about 100 million years old. Not really changing in the last 100 million years. Or it can maybe be based on information theoretical principles, which is little something the kind of direction we want to go. And this generates normally commands, and you get locomotion. But it's actually not what we are doing. What we are doing is this one. It is self-organized locomotion in the sensory locomotor loop. So it works like the following. You have an actuator, for example, a wheel, or can be something else. You measure the state of your own actuator, for example, the angle or the angle of your joint or whatever your actuator is doing. You measure the state. From this measured state, you generate a motion. Now that makes something happening in the environment. The animal, the robot is moving. You have forces from the environment. That changes the angle, the state of your actuator. That generates a different kind of a reaction, and that is what is called the sensory motor loop. So there's it's only proprio sensation, 100%. Of course, it's extreme case. It doesn't need to be so extreme case, but we consider here the extreme case of 100% proprio sensation only. No other outside sensors working on this. So it's a closed loop between environment, sensor, controller, and body. And only when the loop is closed, locomotion occurs. If you cut the loop, so if there's no feedback of the environment, the robot or the animal will not move in. So it's only moving because the loop is closed. So that's so there's no central pattern generation. And to show you, before I show you, so there are examples, what is called also, it has closely related to embodiment. We have seen this week by Jimmy a wonderful example of embodiment, the dead fish swimming, namely the physics of the body does most of the job, and the neural network needs just a little bit extra control to make it moving. Another example is the famous passive walker. This walks down here a slope, so there's some small inclination. And of course, it couldn't go straight, but you transfer energy to the robot in this case, and it has some kind of walking gait. But it's 100% passively. Now the idea is, if you have something like that also on the floor, it would do this passive walking. You just need a little bit extra motor power to make it walk in the natural fashion. So humans walk mostly by kicking the leg, then you fall, and the body does mostly the rest. And the idea is not that you passively walk all the time, but you just need a little bit extra control complexity to make it walk in a normal way. But most of the work is done by the dynamics and the physics of the body, and that is what was then called embodiment. And the dead fish swimming is a perfect example of that. So that is the kind of, and I think we believe that many animals, like for example the kangaroo is a famous example, it hops and it stores energy in the tendons. Stores energy in the tendons, and that's why it can, and it releases energy again. So the physics of the body does a lot of work. So any questions? Yeah. So this one here has, of course, no control at all. Just physics. There's no. Yeah, this is absolutely passive. Sorry?
The word self-organized.
Self-organized means you don't give it a goal. You have a set of equations. You don't really control what it's doing, and complex behavior comes out of that. There are people then going further, like guided self-organization, where mostly it's self-organizing, but you somehow guide it a little bit to do in the direction what you would like to want to do. But self-organization means you don't tell it now, here, there, and there.
Question?
Yeah?
So, I mean, there are no walking robots around us, right?
Yeah.
So there must be some bottleneck in the design of walking robots. So, it's just a very general question. Is it the software limitation or hardware limitation? Meaning that you mentioned that there's a point of dynamics that helps a lot. Maybe the actuators are not.
Yeah, the actuators are difficult. For example, we have all these counteracting muscles. They are a little bit difficult to implement because you need tendons, but people are trying to do that. But it's mostly the control problem because, I mean, we have many muscles, but we don't give control. Let's say your muscles constrict by 3.5%, the other one has to contract by 7%, but the robot has to do that. Because we don't need to do that because we are highly compliant and the body does most of the rest. So I think it's generally accepted at the moment it's still, they are fully actuated, it's called. So you control exactly every actuator percentage-wise, and this is difficult to make it. Well, you can do it, but you do it slowly and and if something happens, you fall over. Right, yeah?
Yeah. How are you defining walking? Because there are walking robots. Look at Boston Robotics, for example. I mean, those are what I would call a walking robot. Kick them over to get back up again. You know, they jump, they can do somersaults, things like that. how are you defining walking in that sense?
As you said, it's not a one to zero. They don't exist. Now I think, as you say, it's they're improving in these years. It's not what we're talking about. Like a few years ago, it was very difficult. Now the improvement has been made, and many of these, so these Boston robots, they are often limit cycle robots. So they have some, well, depending on the design, that different designs. So some of these are incorporating these kind of robustness principles, and that's why they're very stable. So they are not anymore fully actuated like they used to be. All right. But that's all technology, and we are theoretical physics, and we are trying to have a full understanding of what we are doing. And in order to have a full understanding, we want to have it as simple as possible. So we are going to have minimal control complexity, maybe one or two or three neurons per robot. So just absolutely trivial. But the advantage is we can have the phase diagram, bifurcation diagram, and we have a full understanding of what is happening. So just in order to show you what I'm talking about is this kind of very simple simulated robot. And so it has two wheels, one neuron per wheel, a single neuron per wheel. Both wheels are independent. They don't know about each other. Every wheel knows only its own angle. There's no other sensor than the angle of the wheel. And that is what is called self-organized in the sense it does relatively complex stuff, but it has, by its own feedback of the wheel by itself. Yeah, 1 degree. And there's no other sensor like that than the own angle. And I will explain in detail how this works and having more complicated example and also have it in real world. But that is kind of locomotion we are talking about by here. Yeah, so that's, and you cannot really tell him what to do. So that's why it's self-organized. And so there's a lot of embodiment in the sense the physics of the body and the physics of the body going up the plane and with the gravitation couples all that stuff together. Okay, it has another wheel here just for support, but it's a passive wheel here. Okay, some overview, what I want to go to tell you. One of the reasons we are looking at these kind of robots is we want them to have them in the future as a platform for testing cognitive systems, which mostly are based on information theoretical principles. Well, we want to do that in the future, but that's one of the reasons we are developing these kind of self-organized robots. I'm not going to talk about that, but there are quite a few people or community interested in seeing what kind, if we can just understand cognitive information processing just by looking at the biological details, but on the larger scale. Maybe have heard about the free energy principle by Carl Friston, or empowerment by Polanyi, and we like the stationarity principle. I'm not going to talk about that here, but I'm just saying there's quite a few community interested in testing out this principle, and that's very, very difficult at the moment. So not many tests have been done whether these are really valid proposals or not. But so this I will just mention. Most of my talk will be about embodied locomotion. And so I will talk about limit cycles and also chaotic attractor, which arise in the sensory motor loop by 100% feedback. And it may be a theoretical concept, but it may also have some relevance to community here. Maybe not as 100%, but as an aspect which may be relevant for animal locomotion. Not in this pure case, like we consider it here, but as an aspect. And navigation comes in on top of this self-organized locomotion, and we can have two kinds of navigation. We can generate these motor primitives, and we can modulate these motor primitives by changing the parameters. or by kick control, namely by going from one motor primitive, kicking the animal in another state. And lastly, I will talk a little bit, just two slides, about multi-objective navigation, namely what happens if you don't have just one task, but you have several tasks, and you want to achieve all these tasks after another in a self-organized way, that you switch from one task to another, but not because you do an if and then, but because you go to a task which is like an attracting state in dynamic system theory. You want to go where the order concentration is highest, but then you have done that and you want to do something else, and it's doing it in a self-organized way, and we have some principle for doing that. So this is here my only slide on the general principles. As I said, it seems that what is studied mostly in this conference is evolutionary optimized networks. And I've once read, I don't remember where I have seen that in which paper, but there was a statement that the C. elegans network changed only by a few percent over the last 100 million years. So it's really a very, very robust neural network. On the other hand, I'm coming more from the neuroscience perspective, and the human brain may be more in the other extreme, not evolutionary optimized, but more, of course not 100%, like towards the universal learning machine. And the general argument is we have only about 20,000 protein encoding genes, but we have many, many neurons and synapses and compartments. And so you cannot really genetically encode everything, but you need some generic developmental principles. And there are people trying to look at these kind of principles, and we are also trying. So this is a general background of this work. Okay, but let's come to our small robots. And the robots I showed you have all the same actuator based on the same principle. Namely, you have the sensory inputs, so your own state. For example, for the wheel, it's the angle. Actually, we take the cosinus of the angle. That's the input. And as an output, we have one neuron in between. The output is the target angle, so where you want to go. So you have a measured angle, the actual measured, the sensory input, and the output is the target. And then between the target and the measured angle, we put a spring, a simulated spring. And this spring gives you the force which pulls your actuator to the desired state. But the force is just a string because there's an environment in between, and you may go there, may not go there, because it's all the environment and the body of the robot and everything, the inertia in between. But all our actuators are exactly, our controllers are in this principle. You measure your state, you say where you want to go, and in between you have a force to go there.
Is there a damping in your spring?
Sometimes yes, sometimes not. But yeah, we can have both of that. Yeah. And we can, so this is one neuron between the actual, the measured input, the output. We can also, of course, have some other higher order control, which we don't have at the moment. So we can put them in order to modulate that. But the sensory motor loop is this one. So it's extremely simple. And in terms of equation, that's all the equations which are there. The wheel position, we take here the cosinus. We have a membrane potential, so we have a rate encoding neuron which is integrated up, so you have a time constant of integrating up your membrane potential. Then you have a transfer function between the membrane potential x and the output of the neuron y, which is just a sigmoidal, and then we have the target position. So essentially what we have is a simulated steam engine transmission rod, because in the classical steam engine, we have the problem that we have the force on back of a steam piston we have to transmit into a rotational motion. And now what we have is a neuron which has a force on back, so activity between 0 and 1, And we want to transmit this activity 0 and 1 into rotational motion. So in this sense, the force and back of the steam piston is like our activity of the neuron. And then we have this this transmission rod. And then the motor force is in the tangents of the tangents of the rod on the wheel. So it's in this case just analogous to the classical steam engine. And the key issue is you can go forward or backward depending on the initial condition. So classically, you would say, oh, I encode the velocity. So if the neuron is active, I go forward. If it's inactive, I go backward. That's not the case here. We have a limit cycle. You can go forward or backward depending on the initial condition. So we have at least two attractors here.
In what sense is this neuron like as opposed to just an actuator or a control?
Well, you can call it like, you can call it just a normal controller, but it's also a normal rate encoding neuron, which has been used 10,000 times in rate encoding neural networks. So you can call it either way. Yeah.
That's a neural controller.
Yeah, right. And there's a single one. Yeah. And so, for example, if you put them together, so this is a train. So we have now 5 cars, 7 wheels. Every wheel is independent. Every wheel has exactly this controller. So every wheel knows only about its own angle. They don't know that they're part of a train, but they're synchronized together. And I will explain a little bit more in detail what's going on here. And so that is what is called self-organization. Even so, every wheel is only working on its own. It does do relatively complex stuff, like pushing this block around. Yeah?
What is the goal and angle of the wheels here?
So the target angle is changing all the time because it's depending on the input. So the activity of the neuron depends on the actual state, which is measured. So the actual state is measured. And then just a linear transformation of the activity is the target, so changing all the time. So it's always forward, otherwise you wouldn't move. You're always pulling it. So you move, input changes, your target changes, and that is that's why it's a loop. It's a feedback loop.
So why the length of the spring?
So the spring. What do you mean?
Why
is the neural activity? That's a sigmoidal. So that's just a standard sigmoidal, which is a factor of 2 for the slope. But this is just called, in the neural network theory, it's called the neural activity of a rate encoding neuron. We use this why because, well, that's normally what in a neural network, that's how it's called, yeah.
Yeah, this is pretty cute. So in this very simple nonlinear dynamical equation, there's only like a limit cycle solution or there's a bistable solution. And if somehow we design this single neuron equation slightly more complicated with this bifurcation or bistable state, what would affect the local motion decision?
Yeah, I will show you. There are more solutions. There can be also chaotic attractors depending on the parameters. Uh-huh. So if I change the spring constant, make it much larger, it may tend to a chaotic motion.
I see.
Yeah. Yeah, so in the car, here, so this coupling is passive. So this is just a passive coupling. There's no active. So it's like a spring, which wants to be, but it's flexible, but it wants to stay straight with some damping. It's just a passive coupling. There's no active, like a rubber stick.
Okay.
one neuron per bean, right?
Yeah.
And so maybe you're going to talk about how you get away without having any coordination between beans?
Not any what?
Any direct coordination between fields. It's all through the environment, right?
Yeah. It's all through the environment. That's, yeah. So just wanted to show you a little bit what's going on here. So, here it is. The car is the train is moving slowly, and then it's wiggling. It's not going exactly straight, but there's an instability in the wiggling. It's relatively fast. Now going uphill, it's a little bit slower, and when it's slower, it goes to a different gait, to say, where it goes exactly straight. There's no wiggling. And this is just not designed, but it's a consequence of this coupling, of this rubber road coupling between the car. Then when it's slower, it's in a different gait than here, because here it's wiggling and here not. And when it goes downhill, it accelerates, and it becoming this wiggling becomes larger and larger. So now I will also explain why it changes direction. We will going to that. So what happens here is it accelerates because it goes a little bit downhill, and these sideways swings becoming larger and larger until it becomes here a very large swing and goes uphill and then changes direction.
So
yeah.
Are you saying there's a critical speed which might correspond to the internal waves?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what's happening here. And so then I will explain in detail why it will change its direction. And here, this is also, of course, not organized. So if you consider you want to program some kind of train that it pushes this block, it would be very difficult. Of course, this is what it's called self-organized. There's nothing programming here. Questions?
Have you actually built one of these and saw it
work? Yeah, so we are going to come to that. So before we come to that, although I will show you this will be a Lego robot. But before we come to that, I would like to give a small, very small introduction to dynamic assistants, because I'm only going to talk about attractors and bifurcations. I think not everybody is familiar with that, so I have four or five slides, just very basic dynamic system theory. In dynamic system theory, we may be talking about unstable subtle points, stable subtle points. So maybe you know Newton's equation of motions. So the derivative of place is the velocity, and Newton's equation of motion is the velocity. Change in velocity is the force, which may be the gradient of potential. And then maybe you have a friction force, which is proportional to the velocity, and with some friction coefficient gamma. Now, in our system, dynamic system, the friction force can be positive or negative. We talk about dissipation. If it's positive, you always lose energy. But you actually, we also can take up energy if the friction coefficient changes sign. So a typical example, it's here. You put in water, and you take up energy, and when it's going on the other side, you lose water. And living systems are adaptive because they change between dissipation and energy uptake. So that's very important, that we continuously change between energy uptake and energy dissipation. Now, what we talk about in dynamic system theories is about bifurcations. And bifurcations occur when you have parameters in your equation of motion, and the state of the system changes. Very famous is the pitchfork bifurcation, which is by this equation of motion. The time derivative of x is x times a minus x squared, which you can also write as the gradient of some potential. And now, if a is negative, you see x dot is always negative. That means you have one fixed point, x equals 0, which is stable. But once A becomes positive here, this fixed point splits into two stable fixed points, which are the square root of A, and one unstable fixed point, which is zero. And so we have a bifurcation, which is called the pitchfork bifurcation, like the pitchfork, from one stable fixed point into two stable fixed point and one unstable. This is very famous because in the physics, in the Landau theory of phase transition, that's exactly what's happening. If you have iron going from the paramagnetic state to the magnetized state, that's exactly a pitchfork bifurcation. It's called the Landau-Ginzburg functional. And you have one stable fixed point here at high temperature, and at low temperature you have two stable fixed point with different kind of magnetization. Well, that is typical stuff we examine in dynamic system theory. How does the state of the system changes as a function of the parameters? For locomotion, we need limit cycles. And limit cycles is a self-stabilizing periodic motion, because you want a periodic motion, you don't want to have a fixed point where nothing changes. So the simplest example is in two dimensions. So you have x1 is r times cosine of the angle, and x2 is r times sine of the angle. And now let's say it always goes around here with a constant velocity. So the angular velocity is constant. It's not zero, it's constant. Sorry, there's not a zero. Phi dot equals omega is constant. Sorry, that's wrong. And you have a potential for the radial behavior that you want to go back to a finite radius. If you go too far away, you go back. If you're too far inside, you're going back. And you can plot the flow. The flow is the like in fluid dynamics. It's a flow where the flow of the molecules, of the water molecules, it's the flow of the dynamic system. So you see, you always the flow is going towards this limit cycle. If you're inside, you go outside. If you're outside, you go inside. And then you have a stable periodic motion. And one example, very famous example, is a firing a neuron. And so we have many of these limit cycles in our brain. And that's why we are thinking. And so how do you get then from a fixed point to a limit cycle? Very famous is here the Hopf bifurcation. So you have a parameter, like this is constant, sorry, phi dot equals constant. R dot has now, it's not always, has now a parameter gamma. If gamma is negative, R dot equals always negative. You go to a fixed point. So you have a fixed point, but if gamma is positive, you have an additional zero here for the radial equation of motion. And as a function of gamma here, at gamma equals zero, you have a bifurcation where you go from a fixed point to a limit cycle. So this is x and y, and this is the parameter gamma. A little bit difficult to see, but you go from a fixed point to a limit cycle at the second order phase transition. And what we also have is strange attractors, so chaotic attractors. This is actually one of our robots, which is a sphere robot, which I'll talk later on. And the sphere robot works, goes in the wiggling phase, but it's actually going chaotically in the place. And chaotic attractors, you need at least three dimensions, and then you can, like chaos is, you have exponentially diverging trajectories. Actually, here we have partially predictable chaos, but it doesn't really matter. So we have these kind of attractors, fixed points, limit cycle, and chaotic attractors, and that's it. That are the kind, three kind of attractors we have. Now, we have here, since we are theoreticians, we didn't really want to build a robot by our own. We took Lego Mindstorms, and put it together. That is a children, but it's also used for plenty for research. And it actually has a lot of friction, and it's very noisy and stuff like that. So it's not really ideal. And if it works for this one, I think it should work for nearly everything. You can build some. You can build some, but some sensors, but we didn't use them. So this is a PRIC control. PRIC has actually a Linux system, which is very convenient for us. It's a Linux control PRIC. You can put Python on top of this Linux system. These are the angles. These are the wheels, the motors, and you have directly access to the angle of the wheel. Now, since of the noise, we actually used two neurons, not one. So one of them is working on cosine of the angle, and the other one is working on sinus of the angle. So instead of having one neuron, we have a two-neuron controller, but both of them work exactly in the same way, which I showed you. So working like this one. So we have here, this was one of the questions. Here we have the total force, and one neuron has here the actual, the measured angle, and this is in the target angle, and you see that the target angle also changes respect to the measured angle. This one working on the sinus of the angle, this one working on the cosinus, and the total force is then just added. But both controllers are exactly the same as I showed you for the simulated one. Yeah. So now what the Lego robot does, for example, it hits the wall and it changes direction. And the question what we want to examine, why does it change direction? It doesn't have a distance sensor. The only one thing it knows is the angle of its wheel. It doesn't know that it hits the wall. So why does it then change direction? Now, I would like to explain that. So there's nobody telling the robot to change the direction. Now, what's happening is the following. The robot has two attractors, a forward A and B. And initially, it is in one of these attractors. This is the motor power of these two wheels. You see the noise. Both wheels have more or less the same motor power. There is plenty of noise and whatever, but it doesn't really matter. It's extremely stable. There are limit cycles, so the left and right wheels. And you are in one of these attractors because you're going forward. It's a limit cycle. Now, when you hit the wall, you cannot go any more forward, obviously. And the limit cycle corresponding to the forward direction is destroyed. That means you have a bifurcation in the sense your forward limit cycle is destroyed, and you flow in phase space to the only remaining attractor, which is a backward attractor. And so, and then that is why it changes direction. And you see here, it takes some while, nearly a second or so, to when it hits the wall, it does some stuff. But in the end, it flows to the other attractor, and it's going in the other direction. Yeah. Yeah, if one wheel is blocked, it will go around a circle. Actually, you can make it also turn by putting one wheel in the forward and one wheel in the backward attractor. Then it goes around. Yeah, that's easily possible, yeah.
Mostly depend on the inertia of the body also.
Sorry?
Depends on the inertia of the body.
Of course, also, yeah. Yeah, it also depends on that, of course. It depends if there's too much friction, and so it may go to a, if the friction is extremely large, it may go just not moving at all again. If actually, what happens also, if you notice that we put here a map, because on the floor it doesn't work, because the wheel just go on. Because that's why we put the map on the floor. The wheels will just continue to work because there's not enough traction between the wheel and the floor. That's why so it depends on the environment.
You actually have a way to stop it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it doesn't not always work. It's of course nothing which depends on the situation, stuff like that. But it's very robust otherwise. Now, enlarging the a spring constant, you can put the robot into a chaotic motion. So it's exactly the same controller, just the spring force, K, is larger. And so this is a real world embodied chaotic attractor. So it is in a chaotic state now. So it's just changing the spring constant. But there's no neural network generating this chaotic attractor and then giving a command to the motors to move, but it's chaotic attractor within the sensory motor loop. Yeah?
Yeah, this is pretty cute. So suppose I really turn this robot into a vacuum machine.
Into what?
In a vacuum machine.
Yeah.
So this chaotic motion, is it going to be more efficient than the iRobot algorithm available on the market now?
I don't know. I don't know. But it's really—it's extremely robust, yeah, because they're self-organized state. And everybody knows here that in bacteria we have this flagellum, and this flagellum bacteria has these two states: a limit cycle rotation and a chaotic mode. And you can flip between these two states depending whether you want to stay locally or you want to go local distance. So these states are used for chemotaxis and bacteria. Of course, this is a little bit larger.
What happens if you only block one wheel?
You can
actually have the state transition?
Then depends. I'm not sure whether we didn't do that, but it depends. Since this is the reaction of the body is important, it could be that the other wheel goes then into the limit cycle. We didn't do that, or stays in the chaotic motor. We didn't try that. But since it's depending on the reaction of the body, both can happen.
And if you're not in the chaotic mode, like when it was hitting the wall and then bouncing back, so if you just block one wheel there, what do you expect that you will have a...
You will go sideways. Well, it will always... one wheel will go back, and then it will try to turn all the time. So what you can use is kind of robots is what we call kick control. So we have attractors. Let's say we call this an A, B, maybe C attractors. And these attractors correspond to different motor primitives. What you can do, you can give a short signal which puts the state from A somewhere in the attractor B, and then it finds it away. So you don't have to have a fine-tuned control signal because the attracting state. So it can be very robust, very noisy control signal because it's attracting state and it will go there. And this is what we call kick control, and maybe reduce control complexity. And the alternative is, of course, you can also modulate the parameters so that the attractors by itself changes a little bit. So you can have two kinds of controlling, either by kicking it from one to the other one attractor or by modeling the parameter. And so we tried that. For example, we in our Lego robot, we changed the membrane potentials instantaneously. So it's really a kick. It's a zero-time kick, changing the membrane potential from plus to minus, and let it evolve. Otherwise, it's an instantaneous change, and then it changes direction, which is showed here. I think I also have a movie. I have a movie here. So you don't see very much, but what happens is, at this point, the membrane potentials are just changed instantaneously, and then you let it evolve, and it changes direction, force, and back. It's a very simple control signal. You don't have to fine-tune it. And the idea is, it's pretty theoretical, I admit, is you can reduce the control complexity because you don't have to fine-tune your control signal. So that works, whether it's really useful or not is something else, but that is at least a control scheme you can use. Now, since I think I'm going to change that, So we have all these route to locomotion, but since we started late, I will change that. I will not talk about that. Let me talk very shortly about a different kind of robot we had, which is exactly the same principle. Namely, we have, it's simulated in this case, we have rods, there's a ball on the rods, there's one neuron which measures the actual position, which gives as the output the target position, there's a spring in between, exactly the same way as we had before, and we have three of them perpendicularly, and actually there's then coupled via inhibition, the three neurons are coupled via an inhibitory feedback between all of them. So that is what's happening here. So the ball can move around because it's like this Star Wars robot, which has this sphere and has to move somehow. So these balls move, and because of the inertia in between, all the robot moves. Now, there is inhibition between all these three neurons, and the inhibition is this short-term synaptic plasticity. I think I will skip that. But now you can map out the full phase diagram, since it's so simple. And we have two parameters. This is the excitatory input, which is the actual position, the coupling between the actual position to the neuron, that is positive, and the inhibitory coupling between all the three neurons. We have two parameters, and we have many different modes how the ball can move. It can move circularly, like a star. It can wiggling forward in three different modes. And most importantly, the region phase space where only one mode is stable, or the region phase space where several modes are stable. Now we have six of these balls color-coded, and you see they can move in different gates, to say. Starwise, you can move forward, going forward in a snake ride. And now you see they can interact with each other just passively, because they bump into each other. They don't have any other sensors than their own position. And we see several things happening. Is this blue one, obviously, is in a state of phase space. We have two modes, going forward or going into circle. The green one is in a state space where you have two forward modes. The yellow one is in a state space where you have only one mode, namely going into circle. You can bump as much as you want. You always will stay in a circle. And the pink one has also two modes, going in a circle or going starwise. So we see it's pretty, I think I will start it again. So that is also in certain sets kick control, because here they kicked already. Now this is stable here. It was just kicking back, so it just changed direction. But now when they interact, it is kicking the blue one into the basin of attraction of another gate. So it was kicked in the basin of attraction of another gate, and it changed the gate. So that is, but some of them, depending on the parameter, you have only one gate, you always remain in the same gate. So you have both possibilities. We also have two. Yeah, then it's a barrier. We started with that. Then also, it's pretty complex, yeah. But we tried, actually, this is why we started with a barrier. Now, unfortunately, they're a little bit difficult to build in real world, but of course, it would be nice to build them in real world, but it's a little bit more difficult. That's why we changed to wheeled robots, because they're much easier to build. Yeah.
So with this string neural algorithm, yeah. So
yeah.
Do you also have a region where you might have three stable patterns?
I think the maximum we had at the moment we could find were two. But theoretically, there could be, but we didn't find that.
I think.
Yeah. That would be nice, yeah?
Rolling, no slip, I guess.
There's no slip at the moment, yeah. But yeah, but if you make them very fast, they can also slip and bounce. Yeah, it works, of course, but then they have different gates and stuff like that. If you make them very fast and you make something, they would bounce a little bit, yeah. And so changing the parameters here, actually, there's also chaotic modes. This is now a little bit faster, so it's actually slower in real time. It's an accelerated movie. Now this is in a chaotic mode. It sometimes goes transiently into this ring mode. And so that's what one calls self-organized, let's say, playful behavior. So if you give this to a child, which we show to some children, they would say, oh, it's playing around with these boxes. Of course, they're just three neurons doing their stuff. It's a very simple dynamic system, just three neuron controller. But if you give it to a child, it would say, oh, it's playing around a little bit, pushing around these boxes and exploring a little bit, seeing what you have in the what you have in this playground. But so that's but you cannot tell it to do it. It's just emerging behavior. But the upshot is it's extremely simple, and you can control it from a dynamic system point of view. Okay. And you can look actually at the frequency pattern, which is actually pretty interesting. These six different gates are what these three neurons or the three the position of the doing. They can be so the normal circular one. We have exactly two pi over three shift between them that otherwise identically. We can also have spontaneous symmetry breaking between the three neurons, and you can look at the frequency patterns of these three actuators relatively, and you have a very interesting kind of self-organized frequency looking.
Sorry, one line question. Within the gate, can you change the speed?
Yeah, by changing,
So this reminds me of the somatic gastric ganglion.
Yeah.
So, you know, it has these oscillating bursting neurons that are also inhibiting each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it produces several different types of rhythms, and it has dynamical properties that really look a lot like what we're seeing here. I mean, it's these are more complex neurons, but they definitely have this self-organizing property.
Yeah. So the last thing I want to do is just two slides. It's now a simulated robot arm, but in the end we want to put these kind of principles on top of our self-organized robots. But at the moment we just started, we are not yet there. So this is a separate project. But the idea is you have a robot arm here with two angles. It has to catch one of these moving targets. The moving targets, you have to catch one of them. But then you should get bored and try to catch another one. So you could, and this is a paradigm not just for this target, but different tasks. And you don't want to do it, you want to have a generic generating principle for doing that. Just let me show you how this works here in practice. So you have this robot arm, you have some moving target, you catch one and you're becoming unstable or boring, you go to a different target, you follow it a little bit or not, depending on what you're doing. Maybe you go there again or you go to a different one. And for us, these are not just targets, but we want to generalize it in a way that this could be arbitrary tasks. So you have switching between tasks. You achieve one task you're following, and then you switch between the tasks and do something else. Because we believe in this way, we may have a possibility to generate complex behavior. And so now the equation of motion for these ones are these ones. So what we have is the following. We have two angles. I do it here for the angle, let's say, alpha. I have exactly this dynamic system I was showing you before. So the angle alpha has a velocity. So the rate of this changing is V alpha. And this is in the motor force. This is the force which I give to the actuator, velocity, because well, actually the velocity point is the motor force, sorry. And we have, so the angle is changed here in this case just very simply by straightforward minimization. So we have a potential function which is minimal whenever I reach a certain target. So it has many minima. For every target, it has one minima. And I go down the gradient, very simple, going there. That's very trivial, going down the gradient, reaching a certain target. But then I have dissipation. And the dissipation is in this way. I have my potential function, a u0. Now, if I'm very far away, u is large, my dissipation is negative. So just going to the target, and I have negative dissipation, I lose energy, so I go to the target and remain there. But then, if I close to the target, the sign of my dissipation changes and becoming negative in this case. So that means I'm taking up energy again. So once I reach the target, instead of losing energy, I'm taking up energy. That means I'm accumulating energy until I'm thrown away from my target. It's a very simple principle. So if you look here at the evolution of the energy, so you have E, it's the velocity squared plus the potential function, and the change of energy this time is exactly like that. It's proportional to V, the velocity squared, times this prefactor, and it changes energy. So our idea is this is a kind of possible universal principle to change between targets. A task is an objective function where you want to go, but once you are there, the attractor becomes unstable and you're thrown away again. So that is our idea, and that is the outcome of these equations. It's a little bit more complicated normalization, but essentially the two equations I've shown you are doing this job here. Has the same equation. The two equations, one for alpha and one for beta, the identical equations.
And sorry, I'm not quick enough to know. How are the dots? How are they moving?
These ones, they are just moving ballistically. So what I put here was a square potential, and they're moving slowly in the squared potential in this case. I could use something else, some random motion. In this case, they're moving slowly in a weak potential. But I could use something else. This is just to make the movement. Yeah?
So is there a wide range of control that you can actually control the duration length for the target?
Yeah.
By the parameters?
Yeah, I can do that, yeah. That's very important. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's why I said they're essentially these equations a little bit modified in order to have this degree of freedom.
Also, with the specific set of parameters, is there some chance that when you have multiple objects happen to be on the same spatial spot, which is too strong, so that somehow this dynamical system got stuck?
Well, not for eternity, but no, I don't think they get stuck, but okay, this is work we just started a few weeks ago, so we don't have everything. So this is I put this because our idea is to have then these robotic platforms which are self-organizing, and this is kind of now of cognitive principle because you have a task on top of that, but we didn't yet put it together. It's future work, and then it should not be a robot arm, but something really moving around, trying to do something. Once it does that, it becomes unstable, it does something else. And we're trying to generate complex behavior by that, but this is future work. But this is just to tell you which is our one of the aims why we are doing that. And I think that's it. So, yeah, that's I'm telling you what I told you. I think I'll leave this for you, and thank you very much for your attention.
So this reminds me of a very early model for example, limb control, which was the equilibrium point model, where you set the strengths of the springs in the muscles, and you automatically go to a new equilibrium point. And this was very early idea, which, you know, is not unreasonable. And you generalize that from fixed point to a limit cycle, and so it's much richer.
Mm.
But what's interesting, though, if you look at, and by the way, co-contraction is something that we do when we're trying to be very precise, when you have two things that are fighting against each other, but it's very inefficient. So if you look at someone who's learning how to play tennis, at the beginning they hold their racket very stiff, and then once they get the fluid motion, they're no longer co-contracting. It's basically using full force of one, the flexor or the extensor. But there's it's a dynamical system, and walking, for example, is a good example of that. I mean, there is a limit cycle there underlying it, and a central pattern generator. But it's a very sophisticated system that is dynamically stable, and you know, so you're always stable. You're always in a situation there where it's on the ground and it's sitting there and rolling. And have you thought at all about dynamics?
Yeah, it's like walking. Yeah, well, as I said, we take here the freedom to explore, even if it's not directly relevant to biology, the next thing we want to do, but it's also stable, is a spider robot, but it's more difficult. I think there, and to go to walking, it's very. I think you need, without active control, it's very difficult. So you have to have a reaction, and you have to have other sensors to react that, and I think it's very interesting. But since we are a theory group, we just buy robots which are ready. We don't build robots, but we buy them. So we will buy one of these wheeling robot or spider robot, which you can just buy and put your Linux system on top and put your controller. That's a lot of fun. Yeah, but you're right, but I think other groups will be much more equipped to do that. Yeah.
So, I mean, there should be a real biological robots that control, each ring is controlled by thousands of robots. So what do you think will change in the
community? Well, that's completely correct. So the IR idea is, it's not only our idea, but a few people trying, is for industrial application, a real world robot, you have to do what one does nowadays. I think at the moment it's very difficult to go. I mean, you can put a little bit of this principle, but otherwise you have to hard control them. But the idea is to see how far we can go. So. You're completely right. I mean, we cannot just adapt the theory to do that.
I mean, maybe in some statistical sense, we can describe the population.
Well, I'm not quite sure whether a statistical theory is good for robots, because you really have to react to. Walking is not a statistical property, I think. but as I said, our outlook is our point is to to explore how far you get this kind of universal principle. So you can either put some tasks on top of that, and they're doing some meaningful tasks, but then it switch between tasks, and you don't have to hardcore all navigation, putting a GPS map, and whatever you do. Of course, we won't get very far with that, but maybe we can get to a certain level of which looks like a biological. So what I would like to have is a small robot which follows me like a little dog and goes around, maybe going, playing around, and it's built on this universal principle. If a child would see that, it couldn't see the distinction, couldn't distinguish between a real dog, apart from it looks differently, behave like it would follow him, going to my leg, bumping against the leg, and then going somewhere else, and doing that kind of stuff. But built on these kind of universal principles and not on if and then. So that is the kind of a complexity level. Yeah?
So, you were mentioning before, I think it was Imam's work, like the stomach of the crab. So, one thing that's really interesting in her work is that she showed that the solution of the expression of the channel and it talks to the fact that in your case you have basically a few attractors, and it seems that it's very important such that then the control is simple. If you have, as you increase complexity, what part of the theory, or like how do you understand the, from a theoretical perspective, the fact that you're going to want to keep the number of attractors small and well separated so that you have large region of so why didn't the theory maintain that simplicity as you built in context?
Well, actually, as I was asked before, this is what normally happens. It's actually difficult to get many stable attractors. So some of this comes out pretty naturally. It's pretty difficult to get many stable attractors at the same time. I'm not sure exactly why at the moment, but that's what normally happens. And since phase space is large, they're normally well separated.
In the case of the biology, you could say, well, it has evolved towards a solution where, it's like that.
Yeah.
But you're saying that maybe there's some sort of principle behind that?
Yeah, it's not so easy to get. Yeah. It's a very good question, but of course, we don't have very large complexity at the moment. But if you look, for example, at neural network with transient state dynamics. So we have autonomous, it's a different subject, but autonomous neural network, which is also, let's say, rate encoding, doesn't really matter, neurons, and you have attracting state, which also become unstable, let's say, because you couple to a slow variable like reservoir or short-term synaptic plasticity. So you go to a well-defined attracting state, this becomes unstable after another time, go to another one. Then you also get limit cycle dynamics. Then now you can count how many limit cycles do you have, how many different limit cycles do you have. And we do that, actually. It's difficult to get a very large number of limit cycles in this one. I'm not quite sure. You get a few, maybe 3, 4, 5 or so, depending if you have a large network of 100 neurons. It's very difficult to get many, many different limit cycles. And I'm not quite sure why, actually. Yeah, so the system, let's say, we do that. We did a system in a simulation, we did that. And its limit cycles are very stable. Of course, you can get rid of, some of the smaller attractors become, let's say, would disappear. Like here, we have attractors which have very small region of attraction. They may disappear, become unstable. But otherwise, it's very stable. So the Lego robot, you don't treat it well. And there's plenty of noise there. That's the idea. Limit cycle attractors are very stable against noise, and they're very compliant. So you change whatever you do, and they react. And of course, the speed will change somehow, but it will go on. Thank you very much. Thanks.